The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These articles are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with a caption from a photograph that accompanies the article that we'll be reading, and we'll tell you more about that momentarily. Let's first go to the caption. It's a large group of people looking at and snapping photographs of a beautifully ornate white stone building in the distance, featuring minarets, domed roofs, arches, and stone inlays. A colorful early morning sky with blues and faint oranges and yellows is visible in the background. A group of people standing in a safari truck look at and snap pictures of a small pack of animals in the distance. We see a dirt road winding its way through lush green vegetation. A blind man holds a white cane against the ground in front of him while he walks across a stone-tiled area with a large stone building adorned with decorative elements behind him. Two people facing away from the camera are visible in the foreground, one wearing a tan hat and the other wearing a pink hat. One of the people is holding the hand of the other, both arms outstretched, pointing toward an immense stone structure in the distance featuring a number of stairwells and arched walkways. Well, for many of us, traveling is an inescapably visual experience, and this is part of the introduction to the article. We sightsee and snap photographs. We prioritize rooms with views. We gaze at artworks, at architecture and nature. All of us have done this in our own traveling experiences. However, for blind travelers, the world reveals itself differently, according to the writer. To find out how, writer Andy Isaacson joined a 10-day journey through northern India on a tour designed for the visually impaired. And this story is really about what he learned. Now, it's called Sights Unseen, What Travel is Like for Those Who Can't See, and goes on to say, serving as a sighted guide in India, Andy helped discover new layers of experience and a deeper way of visualizing the world. And his article was in the April 7th edition of the New York Times. Let's begin the article now. And by the way, there was another picture of Andy, and it says he's a freelance writer and photojournalist, and he guided blind travelers around holy cows, muddy potholes, and whizzing rickshaws while reporting and shooting his story. Now his story. Luke walked beside me, one hand curled around my arm, the other tapping a gentle rhythm with his white cane. We were crossing the Taj Mahal's grounds just after sunrise, the air already balmy and faintly perfumed. From the scattered murmur of tourists, Luke said he could sense a grand open space around us. I described the Persian-style gardens, reflecting pools, clipped shrubs, stone walkways in perfect symmetry. Then I read aloud a sign. Don't make direct eye contact with the monkeys. Near the mausoleum's entrance, the ground changed, rough sandstone yielding to cool marble, smooth beneath our feet. I guided Luke's hands to the white facade, and he traced the stone inlay as he had at the nearby Agra Fort. Now, we have vines, blossoms, and precise geometric patterns cut from lapis lazuli, as he continues to describe, along with red jasper and onyx. And he said some surfaces felt chalky, others slick as glass. As his fingers roamed, Luke recalled the photographs he'd seen as a child before retinitis pigmentosa, a hereditary eye disease, gradually narrowed his vision, and then, at age 18, took it away. "I get the impression of something opulent and magnificent," he told me. Inside, we joined the flow of tourists circling the tombs of Shah Jahan and his beloved Mumtaz Mahal. Their voices echoed beneath the dome, drawn out into long, soft reverberations. In the past, the space carried recitation of the Quran, with acoustics meant to evoke the sound of paradise. Luke tilted his head toward the ceiling. "It's almost like you're inside a speaker," he said. I closed my eyes and listened. What does it mean to travel somewhere new and not be able to see it? That question led me on a 10-day journey through northern India's Golden Triangle with Travel Eyes, a British tour company that pairs visually impaired and sighted travelers. So much of the language we use around travel, sightseeing, scenic vistas, must-see list, assumes that the world is best or only understood through the eyes. But as the writer Pico Lyer wrote to me in an email before the trip, travel is not about seeing the sights so much as opening oneself up to the unfamiliar, a matter of perception and vision in a deeper sense. And now, we're going to have some images injected along the way. Here's one, a woman walking next to a man holding a white cane out in front of him, and there, two of them are passing a street vendor selling orange fruit displayed on a wooden cart. Lush greenery is visible in the background. The second image is Luke and a sighted guide, on a stroll through Bundi, and they're in the northwestern state of Rajasthan. Now the story continues. For years, whenever I returned from a trip abroad, a friend of mine would ask, what did it smell like? I always fumbled for a meaningful answer. What layers of experience, what deeper kind of vision had I been missing? Amar Latif, a British entrepreneur, founded Travel Eyes in 2004 to address the lack of accessible travel options for blind and visually impaired people. After losing most of his sight by age 18 because of retinitis pigmentosa, Mr. Latif struggled to travel independently. Mainstream tour companies often rejected him, insisting he bring a caregiver and excluding him from more adventurous activities like hiking and skiing. Those exclusions pushed him to create something of his own, a company that would allow blind travelers to explore the world without relying on friends or family. Friends and family switch off, he told me. They're not as eager to describe things. Travel Eyes runs on a simple but radical model. It pairs blind and sighted travelers as equal companions. Sighted participants assist with navigation and describe visual details in exchange for a discounted trip, while blind travelers bring a fresh perspective that often deepens the experience for both. The company promises a truly multi-sensory travel experience, with itineraries designed to engage all five senses. Now, destinations include Cuba, Estuani, and Britain's Lake District, among others, and trips often include immersive tactile experiences, paragliding in the Canary Islands, kneading pizza dough in a Tuscan farmhouse, handling museum artifacts typically kept behind glass. On Lake Titicaca in Peru, locals built a miniature Reed Island for travelized visitors to explore by touch. Now, in Sichuan, China, they were granted rare permission to feel the terracotta warriors. To me, India, with its sensory onslaught of honking horns, potent smells, vivid colors, spices, and heat, seemed like the perfect place to experience travel in its fullest, most immersive form. Now, this brings us to another image, an incredibly dense urban scene. It shows motorcycles, cars, trucks, and people crowding the street, and there are pink-orange buildings lining the road in the background, and it's simply titled Traffic in Jaipur, Rajasthan's capital. Back to the story. After I booked my trip, Travel Eyes sent me a sighted guide pack, a short primer. Don't be nervous, it began. Guiding may seem daunting, but once you get into the swing of it, nothing could be easier. No prior experience was required, just a friendly attitude and a willingness to describe what you saw. Each day, I'd be paired with a different visually impaired traveler, referred to as a VI, and please keep that VI in mind, and together, we'd find our rhythm. I met the group at a hotel in New Delhi. Among the travelers were two women, one visually impaired, who had met on a previous Travelized trip. This was now their sixth journey together. And now another image in the making. A woman, she's wearing orange, walks ahead of a man wearing dark sunglasses, holding a white cane, her arms trailing her and holding onto his hand. The two are making their way through a street crowded with bicycles, rickshaws, and other pedestrians. Shops line the road in the background. A second image has a group passing through a street in Old Delhi. Now back to our story. On our first day, I was paired with Daniel, a 38-year-old software consultant from Oxford. It was his 12th Travelized trip. He'd previously visited Romania, Bhutan, and Jordan. Daniel had several eye conditions, including nystagmus, which causes involuntary eye movements and makes it difficult to focus on or judge depth. He often held his phone just inches from his eyes. On a visit to Old Delhi, I guided Daniel barefoot through a Jain temple, fragrant with wafting incense and filled with soft instrumental music, and into the adjoining Bird Hospital, a rather crowded and grimy convalescent home for the winged and wounded. He gripped my arm lightly, reading shifts in elevation through subtle cues in the movement of my body. I told him when steps were coming, how many, and in which direction. For tight entryways, I walked ahead with my guiding arm behind me. I felt like I was getting into the swing of it. Strolling in pairs through the tight, noisy streets of Old Delhi, our group of 18 made for a curious sight. It struck me how rare it is to see so many visually impaired travelers moving together, especially in a place that feels overwhelming even for the sighted. We navigated uneven pavement, wove around men carting guavas and sacks of cement. Susie, a tour manager, called out obstacles. "Rickshaw, passing on your left." We ducked behind tangled wires and tin awnings, sidestepping muddy puddles and motorbikes, holy cows, and dog feces. Shifting waves of scent washed over us, spice, metal, diesel, cooking oil. As our tour bus crawled through Delhi's snarling traffic, Daniel reflected on how blind and visually impaired people make sense of the world. "Everyone builds the world in their own way," he said. "Some rely on the spatial qualities of sound, others on scent, or even the feel of air moving around them. Even sighted people use some combination of these elements," he pointed out, "but when you're deprived of one, you compensate with the others, and everyone does that differently." The next day on our drive to Agra, I was paired with Candy, a blind woman from Seattle who works in taxpayer advocacy at the Internal Revenue Service. Born with glaucoma, she could once detect light in the presence of large objects, but her vision gradually deteriorated. A decade ago, at age 40, she had one eye removed and now has an ocular prosthesis. "The whole sights thing doesn't thrill me," she said. What excited her were immersive hands-on experiences, zip lining, rappelling down waterfalls, whitewater rafting. On a previous travelized trip to Peru, she rode a rickety train and leaned out the window, arms in the wind, as if she were on a roller coaster. In Costa Rica, she tried surfing. And yet another image, it's a woman wearing a green T-shirt, pressing her fingers against a small metal sign. Several other people are looking on. And then we have one of Candy reading a Braille information plate at Humayun's tomb. Candy said she wanted to hear about the reality of India as we continue the story. She preferred descriptions of people, their behavior, and appearances over scenery. "Tell me what they're doing," she said, "even if it's just someone lying on a bench or sleeping on the sidewalk. That's more interesting to me than, hey, there's a tree over there with yellow leaves." I peered out the bus window. Along the roadside were barbers who'd hung mirrors on fences, shaving customers perched on low stools, and flower vendors threading marigold garlands. I told Candy how cars here drive on the left and how clearly marked lanes were almost universally ignored. Vendors had strung multicolored snack packets across the fronts of their stands like strands of vibrant breeds. "Oh, that's interesting," she said. We passed the six-story apartment blocks with laundry fluttering from open windows. "Hmm," she said. "In a lot of places in the States, you can't do that." And still another image here, and it's a bright orange and yellow flowers that's filled a large container. There's a pair of weathered hands can be seen forming a small bouquet wrapped in a newspaper sheet. And then it has marigolds for sale outside the 17th century Jagdish Temple in Udaipur. Now back to the story. At a truck stop cafeteria where we had lunch, I described the triangular structure of a samosa and the ingredients in dal. When used clock-faced references to guide Candy to each item on her tray, she paid for the meal, carefully handling the rupee notes, colorful textured bills adorned with traditional Indian motifs, and Gandhi's portrait at the center. I described those to her too. I was beginning to notice how speaking these details aloud sharpened my perception, things I might have otherwise overlooked or skimmed past, the kind of prosaic elements that quietly define a place, like the black and white stripes on New Delhi's curbs or the mandala murals painted on highway overpasses, became more visible to me when I put them into words. In naming them, I was also etching them into my memory. In Agra, we joined the early morning crowds jockeying for photographs of the Taj Mahal at dawn, its pale, glowing silhouette mirrored in the long reflecting pool. They took a bunch of blind people to watch the sunrise. Kind of funny. And a visually impaired traveler from England, said Riley. We toured the site in pairs. One-sided guide told me she described the domed mausoleum to her partner as a giant Hershey's Kiss. And we have a couple of images here. One, a handful of people traversing across a large red-brown stone surface. They're walking in front of a vast white stone building that's decorated with a staggering amount of ornamentation from arches to stone inlays. And then the second image is of the Taj Mahal in Agra. Now back to the story. One visually impaired traveler recalled his time inside the mausoleum as being deeply moving. I heard this low, generic hum, almost like an filling the space from people quietly talking, he told me. I realized that everyday conversation had created this peaceful resonance, like a background chant. Sighted people probably wouldn't even hear it. They're too busy snapping photos. We eventually arrived in Rantambur, a town in Rajasthan near a national park that was once the private hunting grounds of the Jaipur royal family. Today, it's considered one of the best places in India to spot wild Bengal tigers. Before our safari in the hotel gift shop, I placed a tiger figurine in Candy's hands. She ran her fingers along its long torso and stout legs, tracing the raised stripes. "Wow," she said. "It's much longer than I thought." We toured the park in an open-top bus, its diesel engine rattling as we bounced along rutted dirt tracks that wound through dry forest, open meadows, and rocky outcroppings. Every so often, our driver stopped at the sight of an antelope, sambar deer, or a quick-moving mongoose. Channeling David Attenborough, I narrated for Candy as a peacock fanned his feathers in a slow, deliberate courtship display. As we spotted tiger tracks pressed into the sandy soil, but no tiger. Admittedly, I was disappointed. Candy wasn't. Just jostling through the wilderness in the open air, she said, gripping the handlebar, had been thrilling enough. The next day, I experienced my own version of that thrill aboard an auto rickshaw in Bundi, a hillside town known for its blue-painted houses and ancient step wells. I was paired with Chris, an accessibility specialist for the British government. Highly expressive with his eyes, Chris explained that he had optic nerve hypoplasia, a congenital condition that left him with a pinhole camera-type view of the world. I closed my eyes as we climbed toward Bundy's palace, perched above the town. The sudden jolting turns, the rush of wind, the blare of horns, and the shifting smells, spices, incense, street food, exhaust, cow dung, turned the ride into a visceral blur of motion, sound, and scent. I felt every break, every bump, and every sway. Chris described it in much the same way. I feel all the micro movements. It's like a 1970s fairground ride, he said, as we twisted up the road. A bit edgy, a bit bumpy. It jolts and pivots. It's got that amusement park atmosphere, he said. As our group strolled in pairs through the center of Bundi, weaving between loitering cows and whizzing traffic, our local guide, Manish, paused at a street stall where a smiling man was stirring a drink made from a vivid green paste. Manish explained, a government-authorized vendor, a bang, a traditional cannabis-infused beverage. Inexperienced but curious, a few of the VIs decided to try it. Later, Chris described how the high distorted his sense of time and space. Lying in his hotel room, the hum of air conditioners seemed to harmonize with the sound of the shower, and together they sang. Over the course of the trip, I'd heard a few visually impaired travelers grumble that some of the sighted participants were being too heavy-handed in their approach to guiding, overwarning and overcautioning, as one put it. As we boarded the bus to Udaipur the next day, Susie announced that some VIs felt as if they were being passed around like furniture, with items taken from their hands as if they were children. The issue was clear. Sighted guides sometimes forget that their VI companions are independent adults. I'm another human being, Susan, a VI from San Francisco, told me. I'll say what I need. When someone sees themselves as a helper, the whole relationship gets skewed, she said. And that brings us to some more images. A man wearing bright orange sits on the edge of a stone building beside a stairwell, looking down at a book that he's holding in his hand. Now, around him is an ornate stone structure rife with sculptural elements. And then we have another picture outside of a Jagdish temple in Udaipur. Back to the story. Travel Eyes promotes guiding as companionship, not caregiving. Someone to explore with, to share a drink at the hotel bar with, not someone to manage. But the lines can blur when you're also escorting someone into a bathroom stall. It's a little like a complex dance routine, Chris told me. You have to learn each other's moves and try not to tread on each other's toes, but you also have to give each other room to learn and grow. On our long drives across the Rajasthani desert, past sand-colored cliffs and craggy outcroppings, Munish offered insights into Indian society, the caste system, arranged marriage, the law of karma. If I can't buy a Ferrari in this life, that's fine, he quipped, introducing the concept of reincarnation, adding, I'll wait, I've got plenty more chances. One afternoon, he shared a well-known Hindu parable about six blind men who encounter an elephant for the first time. Each tries to describe it while touching a different body part. One, feeling a leg, insists the elephant is like a massive cow. No, it's a giant snake, says another, gripping the trunk. A third, stroking a floppy ear, imagines a flying carpet. They argue, each convinced his perception is correct. The moral, Munish explained, is that everyone experiences the world differently and that no single viewpoint captures the whole picture. Understanding others' perspectives, the parable teaches, is part of seeing the fuller truth. And still more images. First, a chaotic street scene, and it features an elephant with a rider, also rickshaws, motorcycles, and a bus, all of this seen through the front window of a car. The second image is a street scene in Jaipur. I thought about this later on our train ride to Jaipur when I asked Candy to share some of her most memorable moments from the trip. One had taken place in Delhi just after she stepped off the bus at Humayun's tomb, a 16th century Mughal mausoleum. She felt a small hand tap gently against her arm. Instinctively, she reached out and gave it a squeeze, and the hand squeezed back. What struck her was the texture, rougher than any child's hand she'd ever touched. She realized it must have belonged to a young beggar. For Candy, that brief moment of contact was transporting, a brush with the unfamiliar. I just wanted to hang out with them and find out as much as I could about their lives, she told me. What had shaped those hands? What had they endured? What did survival look like day to day? And then we have some more images coming up, and I'm going to read her final comment. It says, it reminded me of something Mr. Lateef told me about the difference between how blind and sighted people experience travel. For blind travelers, it's like reading a book. For sighted ones, it's more like watching a film. Now, back to those images, we have a man wearing a white shirt and white shorts walking past a set of murals depicting geometrical patterns and people in various uniforms. On the right are two people near a wall, one seated and one standing. And the second one is murals at a railway station in Rajasthan. Now back to our story. Sighted people tend to rely on immediate visual cues, architecture, color, landscape, forming quick, vivid impressions, like a movie that lays everything out on the screen. For blind travelers, Mr. Lateef explained, the world reveals itself more slowly through layers of sound, touch, scent, and spatial awareness. It's a more immersive, interpretive process, like reading a novel where the story unfolds through detail and imagination. And the book, he said, is often better than the film version. On the last day of our tour in Jaipur, we visited a jewelry shop and the Amber Palace, and a hill-type fort of mirrored halls and ancient ramparts. Later, we stopped at a community-run elephant park, the kind of modest place where you can feed bananas to the animals. Susie guided Candy up to one of the elephants. His legs are about the size of your head, she said, and his eyes are directly above you. Wow, Candy replied. How tall is he? Twice your height, Susie said. Candy reached out, wrapped her arms around the elephant's thick leg, and slowly traced her hands along its limber trunk. I asked what it felt like. She paused. Honestly, she said, like a tall, obese man with a big, hairy leg. Well, next we're going to hear about new concepts in airline travel as we read part of an article written by Edward Russell. It's headlined, Will Sky Couches Make Economy Less Miserable? The article appeared in the April 6, 2026 issue of the Washington Post. Well, when flying economy, there are a few things better than the boarding door closing and realizing you have a row entirely to yourself. Soon, economy flyers on United Airlines can guarantee that with the purchase of a whole couch to themselves in what the carrier is calling the Relax Row. These rows, designed using technology pioneered by Air New Zealand more than a decade ago, feature three economy seats with footrests that can be raised and locked to create a quasi-bed. We definitely think the world's changing and people are looking for these opportunities, said Andrew Nasella. He's chief commercial officer at United and was interviewed last month. He added, "We often spend so much time focused on the front of the airplane. This was an opportunity to deploy something in the main cabin at a scale really quickly." United will begin selling the Relax Row for an added fee on an economy ticket before the end of the year, with flights beginning in early 2027. The seats will be available exclusively on United's twin-aisle Boeing 787 and some Boeing 777 planes. Now, United expects to have 9 to 12 designated Relax Rows per flight. The airline will give travelers up to three people who book the Relax Row two full-size pillows, blankets, and a mattress cover, which is given after takeoff. And for families, United will provide a stuffed animal for young flyers in addition to the travel play kit standard on most flights. The Relax Row feels like an anomaly as airlines keep finding new ways to make economy flying less enjoyable. Seats are getting thinner and closer together, no window seats, fees for families that actually want to sit together, and that's not considering the headache of actually getting through the security to one's flight. What are these sky couch contraptions worth the price? Like the Taj Mahal is the next section. Summer Hall, an editorial director at the Point Sky, has flown on Air New Zealand's version of the Relax Row, the Sky Couch, and the All Nippon Airways, also called ANA. Their version is called Couchy, with her two young children, and she thinks the product's worth it. "It's the perfect bridge," she said. "I don't need all the fluff of business class. I just need the kids and I to sleep on a 14-hour flight." Air New Zealand provided them with two pillows, blankets, and a seatbelt extender so they could stay buckled while sleeping, she said. For Hull's children, who were 7 and 13 when they flew on the Sky Couch, she said the couch was like the Taj Mahal compared with a standard economy seat. Adults may find the economy couches a little cramped. Caleb Baldwin, an American physical therapist and travel agent who lives in Germany, said she and her husband found the space limited when they flew on the Sky Couch from Honolulu to Auckland, New Zealand in 2020. "Us laying side-by-side spooning, there was definitely not enough room," she said. Her 6-foot-tall husband ended up sitting upright in the aisle seat while she curled up on a mini couch made out of the middle and window seat. And about the cost, get a load of this. Air New Zealand advertises the Sky Couch at 61 inches and 5 feet 1 inch and 29 inches wide. The standard twin bed is 75 inches long and 38 inches wide. A solo adult's paying $1,248 for Sky Couch, in addition to $1,191 one-way economy fare for the 14-hour flight from Houston to Auckland. And there ends our journey on today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler, available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.